The release of over a quarter million diplomatic cables by the whistleblower website WikiLeaks has been likened to this generation's Pentagon Papers and one of the most important journalistic scoops in three decades. But the collaboration between WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and the British newspaper The Guardian hasn't been a smooth one. And joining me now is Vanity Fair contributor Sarah Ellison. Her article on the relationship between The Guardian and WikiLeaks is called The Man Who Spilled the Secrets. It appears in the February issue of that magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Julian Assange was in court today fighting extradition from the UK to Sweden. He's been accused of sexually assaulting two women there, but he claims the charges are politically motivated. Where is this case likely to go from here? Do you know?
I mean, I think this case is likely to last a very long time. He's going to continue to fight these charges. And what we're likely to see is, you know, and a continued – the concern that he has is that they are going to be stuck in Britain while the United States is building its case. And, of course, the sexual allegations are very complicated and sort of – I'm not going to recount all of them here, but it's one of these things that is going to – that the case was brought and then dropped and then brought again in Sweden. He argues that it's politically motivated, but a lot of the reporting that I have read is just that it is – it relates to these two women and these sort of unfortunate encounters in Sweden.
And arguments could be made on both sides. His lawyers claim today that he faces real risk of the death penalty or detention at Guantanamo by the U.S. government. Is that likely?
I mean, I think it's a little bit impossible for me to say what if he would be likely to face the death penalty. One of the most difficult things about the case that the United States government is prosecuting against him is that he essentially performed a journalistic function with what he did with these cables. And one of the things that he laid out at the very beginning by teaming up with The Guardian and with The New York Times and with Le Monde and Der Spiegel and El País in Spain was to align himself with the journalist. And he knew that that would make it politically more difficult for the United States government to go after him.
Well, we have two arguments in this regard. Vice President Joe Biden has called Assange a high-tech terrorist. But writing for Salon.com, the lawyer and media critic Glenn Greenwald has said what Assange has done is no different than what Bob Woodward does.
Exactly. I mean, this is the, you know, I was just having dinner with people and we were arguing about, are you pro WikiLeaks, against WikiLeaks? People are very divided on this issue. And I come down on the side of whether or not you like what WikiLeaks did in this case. They essentially performed a journalistic function because any blogger or anyone who is in a position of sort of dumping documents onto the web or adding some kind of editorial commentary or content to those is essentially doing something that a journalist does.
Although, in a sense, isn't Assange a kind of a middleman, which would be a new thing in investigative journalism?
He is. I mean, he is both, and that is one of the things that is trickiest about him.
He's not the guy who's collected the information. He's the one who people bring it to, and then he then gives it to other people and makes arrangements for other people to publish it.
Well, so he started not doing that. He started as just a publisher of information. And what was interesting to me in watching his evolution was that WikiLeaks has existed long before Cablegate or the Iraq war logs or the Afghan war logs. The first time any of us heard about WikiLeaks was when they released the Apache helicopter video, which showed U.S. military shooting on civilians in Iraq. That was the first time that he really attempted to make a bigger splash with one of the documents that he had. And this was in his case, a video. But what he had been doing was operating for years, just putting out information on his website, and there he wasn't getting as much attention, and he wanted more attention, so he turned to the mainstream media.
But isn't he also protected in a way by doing that? Because when Daniel Ellsberg gave the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Nixon administration went after him and accused him of treason, the courts decided on the side of the newspapers and the freedom of press. So he, in this way, he's almost protecting himself by giving it to The Guardian and then The New York Times and then those other publications.
That was absolutely part of the calculation that was made when the the first Guardian reporter that contacted him, who went to him, was an investigative reporter and made that case very strongly to him, and he agreed immediately. I mean, I don't think it took much convincing for him to realize the political safety that he was getting from aligning himself.
More vulnerable, I suspect, is Bradley Manning, the soldier who is accused of leaking that information to Assange.
Yes, and who has been held for 7 months without actually being charged with anything. But in this case,
solitary confinement.
In solitary confinement, he would be more like the Daniel Ellsberg figure. And you can draw many parallels between their treatment.
My guest is Sarah Ellison, who has contributed to Vanity Fair. And her article, The Man Who Spilled the Secrets, is in the February issue of that magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I wasn't aware that The Guardian came up with the idea of a partnership with WikiLeaks. Who at the paper sought out that relationship and why?
Last spring, when we were talking about Bradley Manning, there was an article in Wired magazine about his arrest. And there was some reporting on the fact that Bradley Manning was arrested because he was suspected of handing over these documents to WikiLeaks. An investigative reporter in London who works for The Guardian, Nick Davis, read that report and said, I want to get my hands on that trove of documents. So he set about finding Assange, and he had gotten a tip that Assange was going to be in Brussels. He went to Brussels, found him in a cafe in Brussels. They have this meeting, and they write, you know, they talk for hours and hours about how they could collaborate on this project. It was a very, I mean, of course, it was entirely secretive and very, very risky for both of them at that stage. But it was, you know, for an investigative journalist, and this is also interesting, for an old school investigative journalist who's used to getting one document or two documents at a time, the idea of getting hundreds of thousands at once was very exciting.
And you can only imagine how many people have been assigned at the various newspapers to pore through them to find certain themes. The Times regularly publishes an article on a certain theme that they have picked up in through various documents over the years.
Absolutely. I mean, what was interesting is how no one really knew at any of these newspapers. So, you know, that you have this meeting in Brussels between the Guardian newspaper, the Guardian reporter, and Julian Assange. And then there is all of this sort of back and forth about bringing in the New York Times. The New York Times sends someone over to London. No one is talking about any of this on the phone. They're afraid their phones might be tapped. They're worried about the U.S. government stopping the publication. But they all sit down and they have this enormous database of documents. And the old school investigative reporters who are tackling this don't have the technical expertise of the sort of younger techies who are coming in to kind of make sense of it.
But wouldn't there have been a bit of a problem convincing Assange to cooperate? First of all, the guy is a bit of a recluse, and he also has been critical of the major media outlets, hasn't he?
He's been very critical of the mainstream media, and this is one of the things that made the partnership so fraught from the beginning. He's very politically savvy. I think he knew that cooperating with the mainstream media was going to give him a kind of megaphone that he didn't really have before. It's one thing to release a video of an Apache helicopter, which is very dramatic. People can watch video and understand that immediately. But if you went to the WikiLeaks website and saw these raw cables, they were very difficult to understand at the outset. So he was getting all these very important and respected news organizations to sort of do the work for him in some ways, which is astonishing. He has come from being an entirely unknown figure to sort of calling the shots with some of the biggest names in journalism.
Well, he's obviously one of those contradictory figures who is reclusive and at the same time wants a lot of attention.
Right.
But you also write that The Guardian and WikiLeaks can be seen as the matter and antimatter of modern journalism. Each represents a pole at the farthest extreme, with the journalistic enterprise as a whole being torn between them. That was a quote.
Yes. Do you want me to explain?
Of course.
Well, I think that this really comes down to, you can understand this issue if you look at the much discussed question of redacting the cables, redacting names from the cables. That was one of the things that WikiLeaks was so criticized about at the beginning. So if you're the Guardian newspaper, and this came up regularly when they were first discussing how they were going to release the Afghan war logs, and this is now, we're talking about in June, last June, Julian Assange really resisted any kind of redaction initially. And The Guardian came to this, and so did The New York Times. I mean, this is a journalists who have done this kind of reporting before know that your message gets completely lost if you, what you end up doing is releasing the names of informants or harming people who are on the ground, because then the story turns entirely away from what you're covering to the fact that you have blood on your hands, which is something that people have actually said quite frequently about WikiLeaks, given that the first redaction was done very quick. The first redaction I'm referring to is with the Afghan documents. It was done very quickly. It wasn't done extensively. There were names that got through, and that was the thing that really helped the anti-WikiLeaks sort of fervor get kick into gear. And The Guardian
was anybody killed as a result?
No. I mean, as far as we know, no one was harmed by this, and that's something that I think Assange points out rightly.
But in the past, similar situations, people have been targeted. CIA agents have been killed.
I mean, obviously, this is the kind of thing like we don't know exactly. We don't know of anyone who was killed. We don't know if this is making people's lives more uncomfortable. One can imagine that it would do that. One can also imagine that that's a very easy thing to fall back on and accuse someone of doing.
But The Guardian and The Times also have a sense of what is appropriate for a newspaper
exactly.
to publish. The Guardian is nearly 200 years old, mm-hmm. A very respected newspaper, although the paper has been sued for libel so many times that its editor can't recall them all.
Yes, that might tell you something more about British libel laws than actually their own record of accuracy. But indeed, they are aggressive and have made mistakes in the past.
Are they I imagine British newspapers are going through the same kinds of problems that American newspapers are going through.
They are.
Is this something that The Guardian saw as a way of propping up readership?
The release of the Afghan war logs, if I'm not mistaken, was the largest single day of traffic on the Guardian website. It might have been the cable, the embassy cables. It was the largest day of traffic. But in any case, this was an enormously successful project for The Guardian. And I think that their willingness to reach out and find someone like Assange and work with WikiLeaks really shows the lengths to which old mainstream media outlets are willing to go in order to sort of save themselves. Both of these institutions, both WikiLeaks and The Guardian, had a whole lot riding on making a big splash out of this.
But you also note that The Guardian performs on the global stage in a way that other British newspapers do not. The Times perhaps used to. Why does this tiny paper have such an international reach?
I think part of it has to do with the way that they approach their investigative journalism, and they're much more aggressive in some ways than a lot of other British papers are. I think that it also has something to do with their ownership structure. They are part of a trust, and that trust is basically exists, that the Scott Trust exists to support The Guardian. Their whole purpose is to support and continue The Guardian. So they get a little bit more leeway in terms of the kind of, first of all, the number of journalists that they can employ, the kind of work that they are encouraged to do. Their editor, Alan Rusbridger, is very, very much behind the notion that newspapers are there to report on this kind of thing.
So they don't have to worry about the concerns of an owner or the political inclinations of an owner.
That's true. And they also have very clear political inclinations of their own. I mean, it's sort of in Britain, unlike in the United States, although some would argue that this happens in the United States as well, there are sort of very easy political lines to be drawn in the newspaper world. And the lines around The Guardian sort of are shifted to the left, whereas something like the Daily Telegraph is on the right.
Well, they've been around 200 years and have been a major newspaper for many years. Mm-hmm. WikiLeaks has only been around for 4 years. But hasn't it achieved a similarly influential international reach in this very short time frame?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that was so interesting at looking, you know, when I was looking at these two institutions, if you can call WikiLeaks an institution at all, but if you can look at these two organizations sort of interact with one another and the kinds of rules and the kinds of processes that exist at a place like The Guardian. At WikiLeaks, what's interesting is in the past, I guess, it's not even been a year. The evolution that organization has gone through in this time has been astonishing. It really is, you know, initially it was sort of falling apart because of financial concerns. Then Assange was becoming very, very much obsessed with these cables and ignoring everything else. There were a lot of high-profile defections, and that you saw throughout the Afghan, Iraq, and then these diplomatic cables, their own evolution in terms of editing and releasing certain numbers of cables, and you can see them becoming sort of more traditional in some ways.
Well, you mentioned that The Guardian is traditionally a leftist newspaper in England, and in England, newspapers take political positions. Mm. What is our sense of where Julian Assange stands? Does he want to stop wars? Is that what why he's releasing these documents?
You certainly get that impression from his both public and private comments and from talking to people who worked with him. At one point, he told a very close colleague of his that he was too busy to talk to him. He had two wars he has to end. So there's no question
which
that—
Which is unlikely.
That he's going to actually end those wars?
Yeah, he's going to embarrass a lot of people.
Right. I think that a single crusade to end both the Iraq and Afghan wars is probably misguided. But I do think that this is actually one of the things that caused Assange to become such a controversial figure. He used to be part of this community that was just purely pro-transparency. So when WikiLeaks was initially operating, they were uncovering wrongdoing in Kenya, all these countries around the world, and at banks and at other institutions. And that was something that people could generally support. They thought that that was a very good idea. No one really saw anything wrong with it. And this sort of motherload of information that he got from whomever he got it from, we assume it is Bradley Manning, really focused his attention in a way on the U.S. government. And that made people both inside and outside WikiLeaks uncomfortable.
Well, it's obvious that the reaction has affected the way he has progressed. If there had been a different kind of reaction, if he hadn't been called a terrorist or whatever, he might very well have not seen himself as having such a narrow focus for the time being.
I mean, I think the information was sort of too good for him to ignore in some ways. I mean, this is, it's one thing to get some interesting information out of a country that people pay attention to occasionally. It's another thing to get hundreds of thousands of confidential and classified material about the U.S. government.
My guest is Sarah Ellison, a contributor to Vanity Fair. Her article, The Man Who Spilled the Secrets, is a featured story in the February issue of that magazine. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Sarah Ellison, who is a contributor to Vanity Fair and the author of an article called The Man Who Spilled the Beans in the February issue of the magazine. You write that it is very likely that neither Alan Rusbridger, the Guardian editor, or Julian Assange fully understood the nature of the other's organization when they joined forces. Now, we've made it clear that the two parties felt they needed each other, but did problems arise fairly quickly?
They did. What ended up happening, I mean, this all sort of culminated in a meeting that was not that long ago where Julian Assange sort of stormed into Alan Rusbridger's office and threatened to sue him sue The Guardian if The Guardian persisted in publishing the stories that ended up being these U.S. Embassy cable stories. And what had happened was that someone within WikiLeaks had actually leaked the documents out earlier than what Assange was anticipating that they would have. And so The Guardian, through a very complicated sort of set of circumstances, wanted to publish the documents earlier than what Assange wanted.
And what's the difference? Why is the timing important to Assange?
Assange wanted to give the documents to the widest possible group of reporters that he could. And he wanted to control the timing. I mean, some people said that he was sort of losing some nerve at that point in terms of what he was going to publish when, because there was so much pressure on him. And The Guardian was really pressing ahead and was getting more and more nervous about the widening circle that Assange was using to kind of buffer himself. And the reason that they were worried, I should note, is that they realized that this material needed to be treated very, very carefully. And I should say that there are 250,000 cables. The organizations, whether it's WikiLeaks, The Guardian, New York Times, El País, Le Monde, and Der Spiegel, have only published a couple thousand of those documents. And so what The Guardian was very worried about was this sort of willy-nilly leaking of additional cables to additional people and additional outlets. And someone, the moment that someone treated those irresponsibly, it was going to bring down everyone who was involved.
Well, it sounds to me like everybody is trying to gain control of this.
Yes.
And they don't always have the same goals. But was it Julian Assange or The Guardian who decided to bring in The Times and Der Spiegel and all of the other newspapers?
This is an issue that is somewhat in dispute. Initially, I think The New York Times was a natural outlet to bring in, and they both agreed that that was a good idea. I think partly—
And did it make them a complete partner?
To make them a complete partner, to give them all of the cables. I think that The Times, one, because there is such strong protection of the press in the United States, they saw that as a very good political protection for them, and that the U.S. administration was unlikely to go after the New York Times.
And then there's the history of the Pentagon Papers.
Exactly, exactly.
But the United States has gone after WikiLeaks, and there are, I'm assuming there are other potential whistleblowers who right now are a bit more reluctant to release anything.
I mean, that certainly is the idea that the U.S. government has in going after WikiLeaks the way that they are doing. And I think that that's largely futile. I think that people who are going to – this is sort of a technological race. There are going to be people who are getting access to information and are finding ways to leak it out despite – I mean, you know – I think it will deter some people, but I think that people like Julian Assange and people who work for organizations like WikiLeaks are going to find ways to access this kind of information in the future.
Well, the U.S. government is subpoenaing WikiLeaks' Twitter account.
Exactly. I mean, I find that bit of news made me really feel like the internet and all of the services that you can use have shifted from something that we saw as this sort of wonderful sign of progress and freedom to something that makes me quite paranoid about using any of those. And I think that that's something that you know, there was an article in The Times just the other day about how the companies like Google, Twitter, Facebook, they're all sort of looking for some kind of guidance about the requests that they're constantly getting from the U.S. government about handing over information about you for investigations, and it puts them in a very difficult position. It certainly puts us in a very difficult position as users of those services.
Well, diplomats are going to be a little reluctant to be as open as they have in the past. But there are any number of followers of WikiLeaks who have left because of all of these attempts, all of the Twitter especially.
Well, I think that the thing that has broken apart WikiLeaks is more a question of Assange's personality and also his obsession with these cables. When I mentioned his evolution, he started as someone who was sort of a pro-transparency advocate. And a lot of the people who worked for WikiLeaks were standing right beside him with that and believed that you should make this information, not just this information about the U.S. government, but information all around the world, open to the public as quickly as you could. What happened was there was this incredible bottleneck within WikiLeaks because they were processing all of these diplomatic cables and all these Afghan war logs and Iraqi war logs, that it took Assange's attention away from all the other leaks that were piling up inside. And people became very frustrated with that, and he dismissed them entirely.
Well, some people have left the organization,
yes,
as a
indeed.
Result. It's not really a democratically run organization.
Of course, no, not. I mean, it's very young, and it is the creation of Julian Assange, and it is run as such. One of the people who left is Daniel Domscheit-Berg, who was known as Daniel Schmidt when he was the main spokesman for WikiLeaks. He left in August to start up his own organization called OpenLeaks, which shows to me that this kind of organization, whatever happens to WikiLeaks, is not going to stop other organizations like it from coming up. There's one interesting thing about OpenLeaks is that they have decided that they are not going to publish information One of Daniel Domscheit-Berg's biggest criticisms of Assange was that there was this backlog of information. And so what he wants to do is just act as a conduit and not be someone who's responsible for the actual publication.
Although if you look at the WikiLeaks website now, it's mostly requests for donations. There's very little information available. Have they stopped what they've been doing? Or are they waiting for the fallout to the release of these three major things to die down before they move ahead? Because he's been talking about having other things like important information about major banks.
Right. I mean, there's this bank leak that everyone has been waiting for. I think that those things are going to come, and they're going to come in a relatively short time frame. It's a pretty small organization and not very organized. One of the things that had held up WikiLeaks from getting some of its funding was that the foundation that they were working for, that they were working with, that was processing a lot of their donations, said that they needed WikiLeaks receipts in order to pay them their money, and Assange just hadn't gotten his receipts together. And so this is one of these sorts of things where they have such a huge position on the global stage, and yet there aren't very many people who are actually processing any of this stuff.
And then you have the ambivalence toward this. On the one hand, everybody wants a piece of it. On the other hand, they're kind of scared. Nancy Youssef wrote in an article this weekend from McClatchy that, quote, just 3 years after a major court confrontation that saw many of America's most important journalism organizations file briefs on WikiLeaks' behalf, much of the U.S. journalistic community has shunned Assange, even as reporters write stories, if not hundreds of stories, based on WikiLeaks' trove of leaked State Department cables.
Yes. I mean, I saw that article and thought it was very interesting. I think
Are they shunning him because of the sexual nature of the accusations against him, or because they're scared of the ultimate implications of revealing everything?
I mean, I think that it's a little bit of everything. One, I don't think that Assange is a particularly sympathetic character for a lot of mainstream media organizations. He hasn't made friends in the mainstream media organizations that he's worked with. Even at The Guardian, where he has arguably the closest relationship, he's now fallen out with almost everyone who's there. I also think that there's something about the diplomatic cable leaks that made people uncomfortable. In the United States in particular, and also in the media, because of its sort of arbitrary nature, it was something that it released everything all at once. And it wasn't as if you had one whistleblower who said, okay, this I think is wrong, and I'm going to hand it over to a news organization and they're going to go and run with that. I think that there's also potentially the unfortunate situation where the U.S. media becomes a little bit patriotic in these instances.
Have the types of stories that have run in The Guardian or Der Spiegel, El País, been different than the ones we've seen in The New York Times and other U.S. media outlets?
There's no question that there has been a different publications have had different interests. I actually interviewed Bill Keller, the editor of The New York Times, about this very question, and he was saying that because The New York Times had covered something like civilian deaths when it came to the Afghan war, because they had covered that in real time, they didn't cover that as extensively in this round of coverage from the WikiLeaks project. But The Guardian was always the people of The Guardian were always sort of telling me and saying that they were covering it much more aggressively, and they were covering things like civilian deaths, where the New York Times was covering something much more like the role of Iran, there was all sorts of political griping amongst the different news organizations, or at least political commentary amongst the news organizations about how so-and-so was turning the other way when they were looking at a particular story.
Well, I'd also imagine that the British press is most interested in the things that will embarrass the British government. And
there's a bit of that.
And people in the Commonwealth, the American press is more interested in what's happening as a result of American diplomacy. The Guardian's David Lee told you that, quote, Julian is staking everything on this terrific throw of the dice that he can become the man who single-handedly rocks the U.S. administration back on its heels, and this will catapult him into making it all work again. That sounds a lot like runaway ego.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely an element of that, and I think that what David was in particular referring to was that the lack of money that WikiLeaks was dealing with. These leaks were really too big a project for them. They couldn't handle it. They couldn't process all of it. And Assange was sort of desperate to keep up with it. He was also desperate to keep his organization running. And what he is trying, I think, is exactly what exactly what Leah said. He is not someone, I mean, as you can see, he is now become this sort of martyr figure for a certain corner of the world. And I think that he hasn't done anything to dissuade people of that kind of
position. Anything, he's encouraged, or he hasn't, dissuade. But his situation has encouraged people to hack organizations, which is hard to defend in some cases.
I mean, the sympathetic attacks from the organizations like Anonymous against the MasterCard website are an example of what you're talking about. I mean, I would say in that case too, what happened was that MasterCard stopped processing any kind of a donation to WikiLeaks after there had been such commotion about these diplomatic cables.
And then PayPal.
And PayPal.
Visa.
I mean, it was not the only, it was MasterCard, Visa, and PayPal. I think that those, and Amazon kicked WikiLeaks off of its cloud server and made it go, you know, WikiLeaks then went back to Europe to find a place to host the website. I mean, I think that it's pretty unthinkable. You would never have, say the New York Times had written stories or had gotten a leak and people were going to send donations into the New York Times or were going to advertise in the New York Times, if those institutions would sort of keep that from happening. I mean, it's unthinkable that that would happen to a mainstream media organization.
Is WikiLeaks suffering as a result of the actions of MasterCard, Visa, and PayPal?
I mean, there's no question that that's blocked some of their payments. That is hurting them. It's also sort of catapulted them into a certain level of celebrity and notoriety all at once.
People giving them money in other ways.
Exactly.
Given the amount of problems faced by the relationship between The Guardian and WikiLeaks, are these kinds of collaborations likely to continue?
Yes, I think so. I don't see any way that they don't continue. I think that all of these problems make people much more wary about these kinds of partnerships. I would be surprised if you saw another collaboration anytime soon between WikiLeaks and the New York Times, for example.
The Times has even had more of a troubled relationship?
Absolutely. I mean, they are very much what happened with the Times is that they wrote a profile of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and outlined all of the problems within WikiLeaks and all the divisions within WikiLeaks, and that just drove him absolutely crazy.
And they ran it alongside stories that were derived from the leaks that WikiLeaks had given them.
Yes, and I think they did that with a kind of New York Timesian journalistic conscience, which is that if they were going to be taking stories from this person, if he was in some way doing something wrong, they wanted to be the first people to report on it.
Sarah Ellison's article, The Man Who Spilled the Secrets, about what she calls the most important scoop, journalistic scoop in 30 years, is in the current issue of Vanity Fair magazine. I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.